Welcome to Akhotra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akhotra AI. So today, we're diving deep into a really significant contemporary novel, Ian McEwan's Atonement.
A huge book. And McEwan himself is fascinating, right? He started out with this darker reputation. They called him Ian McCarb.
Yeah, some quite unsettling early stuff. But he evolved, didn't he, into this incredible observer of human psychology, of morality.
Absolutely. And Atonement from 2001, it's widely seen as his masterpiece, really. It's so ambitious in scope.
It really is. It starts like a classic country house drama.
Uh-huh. Very sort of Forster-esque almost.
But then it completely pivots, becomes this harrowing historical war novel.
Oh, yeah.
And then just when you think you know where you are, it transforms again into this really complex piece of metafiction.
It keeps you on your toes, definitely. It's a journey.
It is. So our mission today for you listening is to explore how one single, really catastrophic lie, born from a child's imagination, well, how it ripples across almost 70 years.
And how it forces us to ask a very difficult question the novel poses. Can you ever truly achieve atonement when the harm you've caused? Well, when it's completely irreversible.
Such a powerful question. Let's set the scene. We begin in 1935, Tallis family estate, during a suffocating heat wave.
Yes, and everything hinges on 13-year-old Branny Tallis. She's, our central consciousness for much of the story.
Both protagonist and antagonist in a strange way.
Exactly. She's smart, precocious even, but she has this obsession with order, with narrative control.
Right. She sees the world, especially the messy adult world, as a story she needs to straighten out, give a clear moral meaning to, like her play, The Trials of Arabella.
That play is such perfect foreshadowing, isn't it? Her trying to force everyone into their roles.
And that need for control is what leads directly to the tragedy, when she tries to impose her simple story onto complex adult emotions she witnesses.
All compressed into this one single, incredibly hot, fateful day.
That heat, it almost feels like another character, doesn't it? Everything feels more intense.
It really does. So there are these key moments Branny sees or thinks she sees and completely misreads.
Okay, let's walk through them. First, the fountain scene. Her older sister, Cecilia, and Robbie Turner.
Right. Cecilia, she's home from Cambridge, feeling restless, kind of trapped. Robbie's the housekeeper's son, but he's also Cambridge educated. Brilliant.
And there's this intense, unspoken thing between them.
Definitely. Cecilia breaks this valuable family vase, a Meissen vase, symbolic, maybe?
Of the family's fragility. Perhaps.
It could be. And then she angrily strips down to her underwear and dives into the fountain to get the pieces right in front of Robbie. It's charged with frustration, class tension, and, well, submerged desire.
But Bryony, watching from a window above, she sees something else entirely.
To her young, orderly, slightly melodramatic mind, it looks like Robbie's forcing her, like some kind of attack or humiliation.
So that immediately casts Robbie as a potential villain in her mind's narrative.
It plants the seed. And then comes the letter. Oh, the letter.
Robbie writes two versions, doesn't he? One is sort of formal, apologetic.
And the other, well, the other is this raw, explicit outpouring of his feelings for Cecilia. Very adult feelings.
And guess which one Bryony ends up reading?
Of course, the explicit one. It gets delivered by mistake. For us, the reader, it's shocking but understandable passion for Bryony.
It confirms her fears. He's a maniac, as she thinks. Someone dangerous, uncontrolled.
Exactly. The word itself, maniac, is so telling of her perspective. So now she's got her villain firmly established.
And then the final piece falls into place that evening. The assault.
Yes. In the darkness of the grounds, Bryony's visiting cousin, Lola Quincy, is sexually assaulted.
And Bryony comes across the scene. She doesn't clearly see the attacker, does she?
No, it's dark. But her mind is already made up, isn't it? She's been primed all day to see Robbie as the source of disorder, of threat.
So when asked, maybe even prompted.
She says she saw him. She names Robbie Turner, unequivocally.
And that's it. His life is essentially over in that moment.
It is. And this is where the novel really digs into class, isn't it?
Absolutely crucial. It's not just a mistake. It's who makes the mistake. And who pays the price?
Robbie, despite his education, his potential, he's still a housekeeper's son. He's vulnerable.
His word against the word of a young girl from the wealthy Tallis family? In 1930s England, there's almost no contest.
He's the outsider, the easy scapegoat. His social standing makes Bryony's accusations stick, despite the lack of real evidence. The system is weighted against him.
A devastating portrayal of how class prejudice works.
Yeah.
And the consequences are immediate and brutal.
Shattering. Which leads us, very abruptly, into part two. The setting shifts completely. It's 1940.
Yes, 5 years later, and the personal tragedy is now caught up in this massive historical event, World War II.
The war acts as this great, terrible leveler. Suddenly, those country house distinctions, they seem less important when faced with total war.
We follow Robbie first, right, as a private in the army during their retreat to Dunkirk.
And McEwen does not hold back. It's an incredibly graphic, almost hallucinatory depiction of the chaos and horror of that retreat. Just relentless suffering.
Robbie is just trying to survive, to get to the evacuation point. What keeps him going?
Cecilia, their love. He carries her letters, rereads them. The hope of seeing her again is literally the only thing sustaining him through this living hell, as the book calls it.
You feel his exhaustion, his physical decay? He has this wound.
Septicemia. It's getting worse. His whole narrative is this desperate push towards Dunkirk, towards Cecilia, and it ends. God, it's heartbreaking. His last thought in that section is just, but now I must sleep.
Chilling. Meanwhile, Brainy is on her own path. A very different one.
Yes. Part three follows her. She's 18 now. Instead of going to Cambridge, which she was expected to do.
She chooses something else. Penance?
Seems like it. She becomes a trainee nurse in a London hospital dealing with war casualties.
So she's deliberately exposing herself to the messy, undeniable reality of human suffering. The very thing she tried to impose order on before.
Exactly. It's a stark contrast to her childhood world of tidy fictions. Now she's dealing with gore, pain, death, the real consequences of things. She's facing reality in its most brutal form.
And during this time, she has this moment of awful realization, doesn't she? At a wedding.
Uh-huh. The dramatic irony is just crushing. She attends the wedding of her cousin Lola, the girl who was assaulted.
And the groom.
The groom is Paul Marshall, the wealthy businessman who was also visiting the Tallis estate that fateful night. And Brainy sees him, really sees him, and remembers. She realizes he was the attacker, not Robbie.
My God. The full weight of her lie must just crash down on her then. The man she protected, thriving while the innocent man suffers.
It's the moment the guilt becomes complete, undeniable, and that fuels her next action.
Which seems like the beginning of the atonement promised by the title.
Right. She seeks out Cecilia, who has cut off all contact with her family, and Robbie, who is briefly back in London on leave.
And this is the scene that, as a reader, you've been waiting for, the confrontation.
It's tense, painful. Cecilia is furious, unforgiving. But Brainy confesses, promises to retract her testimony, to write affidavits, to dedicate her life to clearing Robbie's name.
So it feels like, okay, this is going to be incredibly difficult, but there's a path forward. There's hope for justice, for reunion.
You finish part three thinking, right, now the long work of atonement begins. You feel a sense of potential resolution, however hard won.
And then McEwen pulls the rug out from under you completely. Yep. Part four, London, 1999.
The gut punch. It's revealed that the narrator isn't some objective voice. It's Brainy herself, elderly, a celebrated novelist, but now suffering from vascular dementia.
And she tells us.
What? She tells us that the reunion scene we just read, Robbie surviving Dunkirk, their life together afterward, none of it happened.
It was all fiction. Her fiction.
Completely fabricated. She reveals the actual historical truth she'd withheld. Robbie never made it off the beach at Dunkirk. He died of septicemia there in 1940.
Oh, no. And Cecilia.
Cecilia died a few months later, killed in the bombing of the Balham underground station during the Blitz. They never had that reunion. They never had a future together.
So the atonement we thought we were witnessing.
Mm-hmm. Was Brainy writing them the happy ending they never got in real life? It was her standalone gift, as she calls it, crafted within her novel, the novel we've just been reading.
This is where the metafiction really clicks in. The story becomes about the story itself, about the act of writing.
Precisely. Metafiction, where the fiction acknowledges itself as fiction, and it throws everything into question.
Especially the title, Atonement. Can this act of writing be atonement?
That's the absolute core dilemma, isn't it? Brainy herself poses the question, how can a novelist achieve atonement when, with her absolute power of deciding outcomes, she is also God?
If she controls the narrative, if she gives them happiness only on the page to make herself feel better as she faces her own end, is that genuine atonement?
Or is it perhaps the ultimate act of authorial arrogance? A final self-serving fantasy. It's deeply uncomfortable.
McEwen really forces you to grapple with the ethics of storytelling, the tension between truth and fiction.
Did she give them a form of immortality, a kind of justice within the story? Or did she just manipulate the narrative one last time like she did as a child?
There's no easy answer, is there?
Not at all. And it highlights that other major theme, perception versus reality. Her childish perception, imposing a simple narrative, had devastating real-world effects. Now her adult perception shapes the narrative again, but can it undo the reality?
No, because the reality is Robbie and Cecilia are dead. Their lives were tragically cut short because of her lie.
And that emotional impact you feel as a reader, the loss, the lives that were never lived, that's the power of the structure. McEwen makes you invest in that fictional reunion so deeply.
Only to reveal its falsehood. It makes the tragedy even more profound. You feel Bryony's lifelong guilt almost firsthand.
It's a masterclass in structure. The twist isn't just clever, it's essential to the novel's meaning. It forces you to reconsider everything.
So, in the end, the novel suggests that maybe true atonement for something irreversible. Maybe it's impossible in life.
Perhaps. And maybe the attempted atonement, the lifelong grappling with the consequences, the act of telling the story truthfully, or as truthfully as she finally can, maybe that's all that's left.
The moral responsibility of the storyteller.
Exactly. Can art fix life? Probably not. But acknowledging the damage, bearing witness, that seems to be what Brainy and perhaps McEwen suggests is the writer's burden.
It makes you think about how we consume stories, how narratives shape our understanding of truth.
And how devastating it is when that power is misused, intentionally or not.
It's incredible how a story rooted in a childhood mistake becomes such a profound exploration of guilt, memory, and the very nature of fiction itself.
It reminds us, I think, that some actions echo forever, and confronting them honestly, even if only in art, is a necessary, painful, lifelong task.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Acacia Foundation.